This is Wayne Jurnell, editor of Theory and Research in Social Education, and this episode of Visions of Education features a TRSC published author. Enjoy.
You're listening to Visions of Education,
a podcast where we take a look at big ideas in education from different perspectives.
Hi, I'm Michael Milton, a high school teacher from Massachusetts.
And I'm Dan Kretke, an education professor in Texas.
We're here to help bridge the gap between educators in the K-12
and those professors in higher ed. We hope this podcast will help bring those fuzzy ideas in education into focus.
Michael.
Yes, that's me.
You know, we're teachers.
True.
You know, and so, and I'm even a professor. So teachers.
Oh, we actually say this at the top of the show, you know, there's like a whole thing.
That's true. It's true. But so we, when you think of teaching, you think of like the teacher doing stuff. Right. Like the teacher's doing a presentation. The teacher's
we're the sages, baby.
They're waving their hands around and the kids are so inspired by their antics. And, you know, the professors profess. We've got all our strong opinions because we read a book on something.
Ooh, very cool.
But, you know, students come to class with a lot of their own ideas and a lot of their ideas about how the world should be, too. They're not. You know, they do a lot more in the classroom than I think some people maybe imagine or think of when they think of teaching and learning. So my question for you is, can you think of times during your teaching when your students were really passionate about issues or making change in the world that really influenced you?
Yeah, well, do you know what? I'll tell you about a change that students made in my class a couple of years back. This probably is about 5 years ago. We have these like parent-teacher conferences. And it's typically for parents and teachers, but obviously that's a huge voice who's not involved. And one year, there was actually two of my students signed up for spots. They signed up for spots during the day and they came in and they chatted with me about their progress. And I was like, oh my goodness, this is like really, it's a neat conversation. And so it's not really something again that like I had thought of or I had pre-planned. It would have been really cool if I actually started doing this, but they signed up on their own. We talked about their stuff. And then I started opening up to other students if they wanted to also just swing by and we can talk about it. And so I think that just made me think a lot. And I know this isn't about like what they're passionate about, but they're talking about, you know, their how they can be in class and what they want to work on. And it was a really neat conversation. And I've had like some times when like students, you know, students whose parents speak another language, where they would kind of come and we'd also have that conversation, the three of us. But I feel like it was, again, like 5 years ago when this happened. And so now I offer it up to students. It hasn't really happened as much, but for a couple of years, we're going pretty strong.
Yeah, so students can help to change what education looks like, right? Like they have a lot of ideas. We list to them, they can change. And that's like, you know, our schools are theoretically at least democratic settings, right? If we allow them to be, and they can be places where teachers make a lot of decisions, administrators make a lot of decisions, you know, officials do. Why can't students make decisions in those spaces? Can you think of times when they were really passionate about social issues or wanted to make a change with regard to things outside of the school setting?
So one of the things that we've been doing is with our research paper. So, you know, we're teaching research skills. And so I think we have been opening that up to students to kind of like explore more things that they're interested in about kind of like the more current world. And so that's just been kind of neat to see where that goes. Sometimes it's a little bit difficult to like not be supportive because I want to be supportive, but like, you know, trying to like find resources for them. We're definitely kind of in it together, but we've definitely, in my department, have seen some really interesting pursuits into inquiry with that.
Yeah. And, you know, when I was a high school teacher, we had several clubs that were very action oriented.
You had lots of clubs.
Yeah, we did have lots of clubs, and a couple of them were focused on making change in the world. One was environmental club, and our students actually started recycling programs at our school and had to run it. You know, it was a lot. You wish it was able to build into the infrastructure of school, but they really did care about just like how wasteful is our school, right? So they cared a lot about that. We had a group called Stand, which was an anti-genocide coalition. I've probably mentioned that. It was something I was really passionate about that I learned about in college and studied genocides and the American response. And my students were really active in caring about that. And so they got involved in Darfur. They got involved. They also got involved in, you know, the Kony 2012 stuff, that Invisible Children's Organization.
Yeah, we had
in
that.
In retrospect, you kind of see... see some of the problems with it in retrospect. But they were really cared, though, and they paid attention to legislation. They actually went to like one of the senator's offices and protested outside. And like a couple of them like stayed overnight through the weekend. And he ended up actually succumbing to pressure and signing a bill because of it, because of their, not just them, but they joined groups. And so it was cool to see. And I know, you know, one of the, that I'm sure the George Floyd protests for teachers who were at that time, there was a lot of that. But I have also at the college level seen students doing protests against police brutality for years. There's, when I was at Texas Women's University, students did a quote unquote die-in where they all laid outside to kind of try to bring to consciousness some of the things that happened. And, you know, I wonder as educators, like, how we can support students in doing that, right? Like, what is it that we do to make sure that the actions they're taking, like they can pursue them. They don't need us to lead, right? But we don't. And so, but I don't know exactly how to go about it. And I feel like I need some help with that, Michael.
Did you happen to bring anyone along today?
Of course. Of course. You think I'm coming here empty-handed, right?
It'd be a weird podcast, very short.
It would. That, and that's the end of the episode. No, instead, we're just actually getting into it. So we have a fantastic guest who's going to help us think through this issue a little bit more and articulate it a lot better than what we just did.
Nice.
Welcome to the podcast, Ryan Otto. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you here all the way from Minnesota.
Yeah.
Very exciting. But I hear you spent some time in Texas.
Yeah. I bounced around a bit as a kid. And my dad was in college admissions, so I actually was born in Colorado, Colorado Springs, lived there for a minute. Lived in North Texas, Sherman, Texas. Lived in Western Minnesota in a small town called Morris. And then did middle school and high school and also my undergraduate in Northfield, Minnesota, which is just south of the Minneapolis-St. Paul area by about like 45 minutes.
I also bounced around as a kid because my neighbor had a trampoline.
Love that. No, it's interesting. I was, as you all are kind of talking about it, I was thinking, I was brought back to my kind of experiences as a teacher. You know, I was a classroom teacher for 10 years. I worked in all sorts of different schools. I worked in ex-urban public schools that serve predominantly white communities, worked in a private college prep academy where the food was great. Families were really ambitious. Young people were really ambitious. And most recently taught for a couple of years and then served for 3 years as an instructional leader in a Title I school that serves majority Black and brown youth. Through all of those experiences, I think when I think about like, what does it mean to support young people in the work that they want to accomplish? I think it's actually really complicated because in the stories that you're telling about all of these like amazing things that young folks are doing to try to affect change in their communities or more broadly through protests or taking, you know, participating in civil disobedience, there are also these struggles of like, well, what does that look, feel, and sound like in a classroom setting? And I think that the work that I have tried to do and align my kind of political commitments to young folks really has me coming back to, okay, what are the mindsets that I'm bringing with me to classroom spaces, whether I'm in K-12 contexts, whether I'm talking to teachers in like a professional development sort of situation, or we're just like grabbing coffee, or now in higher education, thinking about working with, you know, right now I'm working with undergraduates, but next year I'll be at the University of Minnesota and working in a teacher education program. So thinking about people who want to be teachers, right? So this is something I think about a lot. And so I'm excited to just kind of get into this with y'all.
Yeah. So on that, you know, this is a great intro into your research. And so first you published in Theory and Research in Social Education. So congratulations on your publication.
Thank you. Woo-hoo!
So it is in volume 51, issue 4. If you want to check it out, it is titled, quote, "This is for us, not them," quote, "Troubling Adultism Through a Pedagogy of Solidarity in Youth Organizing and Activism."
Oh, man.
As an adultist
myself, I feel like I'm being
put
on the spot there with adultism. Yes,
I know. As an adultist, I know. I mean, but I right off of that, it does remind me how even just explaining the events that happened in my school, they are coming from, they always came from my teacher perspective and the challenge of getting out of our own heads. So, could you tell us about this study? I'm ready to learn a little bit about how I can get out of my adultism and get into a perspective that really, like, you know, hears and supports the concerns and interests of youth.
Yeah. So I'll set the stage a little bit, the context of the study. This was in the school, the last school I worked at, pseudonym is Racial Justice Community School. And this was a year after George Floyd was murdered in Minneapolis, and Minneapolis is literally blocks away from this community. George Floyd was murdered on a different part of Minneapolis, so this wasn't like in like as close to the school. But that was definitely shaping a lot of kind of the ways we were feeling. We were just coming back from fully remote learning. So we were doing hybrid for the first time. Kids were seeing each other in person in the school, literally kind of like for a few, literally it was like 3-ish weeks. And we were on kind of like an AB schedule. So we only had like 50% of the kids throughout the whole week. And in that those moments, formatively, as we were kind of coming out of fully remote learning, a tragedy occurred in the community where a young black man was pulled over at a traffic stop, and a police officer shot and killed this person. And the other, and so this kind of confluence of George Floyd's murder with this murder in the community, on top of the fact that national media was actually already in town to cover the trial for Derek Chauvin, the media just kind of swarmed into this little suburban town just outside of Minneapolis, and the school district suddenly had to kind of pivot from trying to be the space for kind of remote learning into hybrid learning to like, all right, we have National Guard here. The police precinct is literally across the street from the school. There was this sense that it like just wasn't safe for kids to come to school. That was something that was a really hard choice, I think, for the district office to have to make. I don't envy them for having to make those choices. Businesses were closing their doors. They were kind of reminded of what was happening in Minneapolis in the summer of 2020 with the uprising, the various ways that people were kind of responding to their anger and resentment at the police. And so grocery stores were closed, places where people were needing to pick up things like diapers and, you know, just kind of like everyday necessities were closing. And so the school actually kind of opened its doors in a different way. It said, we're actually going to go back to online learning, but we're going to reopen as this resource distribution hub for the local community.
Oh,
And
wow.
which was a really beautiful thing. And that's kind of its own story. But in the midst of that, these young folks were displaced again. And they were feeling that. And I was talking with a group of youth researchers who I was working with in this after school program. And they were like, we just feel like we need to do something. I was talking to the principal and kind of saying, like, yeah, they're just like, they're really trying to process what to do. And he said, well, bring them up to school. Like, let's try to see what we can do to support this. And as kind of the events unfold, and I'm happy to kind of get into that a little bit more, the first place that I want to kind of like direct us to is that I had access to a ton of stories about young people and how they were organizing, what they were talking about. But as an author, one of the things that I was very cognizant of is like, it's really easy to tell someone else's story, but the lessons were actually that I wanted to share were really about what adults needed to do. And I'm thinking about this from the perspective of like, it's really easy for people to kind of feel energized or feel sympathetic towards the struggles of young folks. It's much harder to take the things that they do as lessons for the ways that we as adults need to do work for ourselves first, so that we can stand with and alongside young people as they're trying to advocate for change in their communities. And it's really, really hard. So that was a story that I just felt really compelled to tell. I talked to the young folks a few weeks after kind of their organizing had taken place as to if they were okay with this and willing to kind of let me engage with that. And they were super down. And so we sat and we processed that. And I had them kind of like checking all of the different stories that I was telling through the process. I know that's kind of like boring kind of method stuff, but the ethics of that I think speak to, you know, when we ask like what does it mean to support youth agency, it starts with these types of ethical considerations of like, well, how are we showing up? And in what ways are we trying to engage with the work they're doing in the terms of like the work that we as adults need to do? Or are we really just trying to share the stories? Because it would have been really easy for me to share the stories and just advance my own career from the things that they were doing because they were amazing.
Yeah, I appreciate you addressing methods because it really is an ethical pursuit. Our methods are when we study anything. I was just reading Joy Boulamwini's Unmasking AI book. If you don't know who Joy Boulamwini is, she was an MIT master's student years ago who started to realize that there was bias in facial recognition technologies. And when she was doing a project at MIT, and she ended up researching it, and her book just recently came out in later 2023. And the thing that fascinated me is how concerned she was and talked about methods that these facial recognition algorithms, they have to pull on data sets, but who gave consent to being used in those data sets? And it is a really hard process to do that, but she cared for it, and it showed so much about her ethical considerations, her positionality, and the type of world she wanted to create. She just wouldn't bypass that, even though it was way more work. So I appreciate the same thing. I'm guessing, I don't know if you called it member checking in your study, but regularly going back to those youth and making sure that it was being presented in the way that they wanted. By the way, I wonder what member checking would just look like for teachers all the time, right? Could this be a regular process where we check in with students, be like, hey, am I actually trying, am I are the things we're doing in the class actually like resonating with what you're trying to tell me we should do? That kind of checking back and forth if we're communicating clearly and understanding each other. So I really like that.
I think it is possible. I think a lot of this work started for me being in the classroom and kind of thinking very much like, oh, you young people are coming into this space very transactionally. No matter what school I was teaching in, it's just that like the more affluent or the whiter those schools got, the more that they knew how to kind of play the game. And so it was like, oh, this feels easier, or like classroom management is less of a problem in kind of the conventional sense. What was different though about those spaces was if I was like, hey, like, is this class working for you? Or like, what kind of activity do you want to do today? Do you want me to like kind of like talk at you today? Or would you like to do a kind of like a group activity where you're gonna like engage with text? Most of the times, what I would get from the like more affluent and whiter communities was just lecture us. This is how we learn, this is what learning is. And when I started moving into the school that I talk about in the article, they were like, no, we don't. We see that as like a form of like school, but that's not what we want to do. We want these other things. And that really pushed me in my teaching a lot. And it was a real gift. I think of it in very treasured memories of how I was forced to grow. They weren't fun in the sense of like being told that you're a bad educator on a daily basis is not fun. And also, those are relationships that I've sustained for, 6+ years since I've had those folks when they were ninth graders. So that's been a real pleasure.
Yeah, so tell us more about this study and how it came about and what came of it.
So I think one of the things to understand before I talk about kind of like what happened, and the what happened, just kind of if you're wondering, is these young people decided to organize a protest for the young black man that was killed in their community on school grounds across from the police precinct where protesters had been staging protests for multiple nights throughout the week. There were, yeah, there, I'll kind of like detail a little bit more of kind of the scenes of those moments, which were really lovely and really challenging in all of the ways that you would expect kind of those struggles for justice to look, feel, and sound. But the kind of framing for this that I think is important is this concept of adultism, which I think can be a really intimidating concept because it implicates all of us, right? And adultism, really simply put, I think of it in, like I'm a newish dad, right? And I love being a dad. And we watch a lot of Bluey. And Bluey is great. But
Thanks.
the thing, yeah, one of the things that I think about a lot is like the difference between facilitating and mediating. And when I watch Bluey, whether it's the parents or whether I'm watching the classroom in their preschool, one of the things that I find so fascinating about how the writers decided to set up Bluey was that the adults in Bluey are actually facilitating a lot more than they're mediating. And meaning to me that what they're doing is they are engaging with the world that the young people are devising, and then trying to figure out in what ways they can engage with it, but not center themselves. Whereas like a mediation is more of like a you can't do this for yourself, so you need me. And right, sometimes like that happens, right? Especially with young children. But to kind of like bring that full circle in a high school setting, and we're thinking about like Dan at the very top, you kind of said like we're, you know, schools are supposed to be these spaces of democracy or democratic learning. One of the really troubling things that a scholar friend of mine, Brian Lozinski, talks about in a book chapter in the book called Sparked, which are these essays about kind of the aftermath of George Floyd's murder in Minneapolis, as he said, you know, schools are sites where democratic life is actually contingent on adults. So young people actually can't do democratic things, so to speak, unless an adult co-signs onto it. Whether we're talking about something like building a model UN, doing a mock trial team, or it could be something more kind of like everyday, right? Like, can I exercise my own right to go to the bathroom? Which ends up becoming really troubling when you start to kind of like take a step back and slow things down, right? It's easy to talk about in the context of when you're away from a school, but when you're in those moments, right? I wanna let listeners know, like, I feel you when you're in those situations of like, we only have 3 minutes left in class and this kid's asking to go to the bathroom and I don't know what to do, right? Like, it's complicated. And it also is an indicator of the centrality of adults in school contexts, private, public, charter, whatever, higher education, like K-12, you name it. So adultism is this kind of like, okay, in what ways are adults central? And then how does that then create this oppressive power relationship between adults and young people, whether we're talking about classrooms, after school programs, or organizing and protesting? And so to disrupt that type of oppression demands actually a very reflexive sort of like in the moment, can I think about how I'm positioned and how I'm positioning myself to use my authority to support what young people are doing? Or am I getting in the way of that? And if I'm getting in the way of that, am I doing that because I'm trying to be alongside them? Or am I doing that because I know what's right and they just need to get on my page? And those are really different things. You know, the best way I've seen this kind of written about or talked about, Jay Gillen has this really great book. Oh, he's got a couple great books. Power in the Room is about kind of youth employment and or youth enterprise and youth empowerment. And he talks about in that text, similarly to his other book, Educating for Insurgency, just because you disagree with a young person doesn't mean you can't support them. And this is something that I think gets so lost in the everyday struggles of being an educator, because every day is hard and it's hard for different reasons. But when we take, again, when we slow it down and take a step back, we see that we can actually support young people. I can have a conversation with a young person who's like, I want to go, like, tell the principal to his face that he's doing a terrible job leading this school. And I can be like, I really disagree with you. And let's talk about how you can do that strategically. Let's talk about how we can do that meaningfully. So when it came to this protest, there were a number of things where young people were like, we want protest signs, we want to do all these things. And the district office was trying to figure out what was going on because myself and a couple of the other adults that I was working with, I had a couple co-conspirators, one that was running the youth research team with me, the art teacher, and then the principal were kind of joining together to kind of say, like, how do we support the work through things like making sure they have the materials they need? And also, how do we make sure that adults who think that they're interested in what's going to happen are kind of kept informed just enough so that they're not getting in the way? And that's a risk, right? I'm not saying that people should go out and do that. That sounded like I got a phone call from a district administrator the first day, and she was like, "Hey, I'm not calling to shut things down, but I am curious. Is this going to look bad for us?" And I was like, I understand where they're coming from. I don't agree with it, and I understand it. And I said, hey, if you trust me, I'll make sure that these things kind of like work out, and I'm giving you the information you need to make informed choices. And we need space so that these young people can see that this is their project and this is the work that they need to do. This wasn't necessarily something that we were doing for them, right? We were just trying to create conditions for that work to be able to kind of like grow in the ways that it needed to. She was willing to kind of like go with me a little bit. And so we just took that and we ran with it. And each day was a different kind of struggle. Some of the things I couldn't do because, you know, being an instructional leader or a classroom teacher is very different from being a principal. So the principal and I would kind of have these debriefs and I would talk to him. I don't talk about that as much in the article, but in the kind of like day-to-day practice of it, I would say like, hey, he would come to me and be like, all right, they're asking these kinds of questions. What can I feed them so that they can kind of like take a step back? But through all of those kind of debriefs and through the experiences on the day of the protest, we learned that the district office, and again, I understand it, I don't agree with it, was really interested in protecting and maintaining their image. They were less interested in the work of these young folks exercising their right to organize, come together, and express their anger and frustration and sadness about the murder of someone in their community. And so through all of that, what I talk about in the article, I use this concept called the pedagogy of solidarity by Ruben Gatzambide Fernandez. And he wrote this really wonderful theoretical piece where he breaks down this concept of solidarity, because solidarity is something that people like to say and talk about a lot. And people who write about solidarity talk about how much people love to use the term solidarity. So it means so many different things to so many different contexts. But what I really liked about the way that Gatzambide Fernandez talks about solidarity is that he talks about it as a relational dynamic. And there are three kind of subsets that he talks about. He talks about relational solidarity, but in the sense of what relational solidarity means is how am I changing because of my relationship to other people? So it's not necessarily like, do I have a relationship? It's how is my relationship to other people changing me? And that's something that I talk about in the article in the ways that I was like, okay, well, now I have to take this risk. If I am in solidarity with these young folks and the commitments that they're trying to make to their community, then I actually have to show up a different way that I wasn't necessarily anticipating on doing. Again, people have to like weigh out their own kind of like political calculations of risk for that. Because I'm a multiracial Asian cisgender male, I can get away with things that, for example, like a Black woman educator in the same context couldn't. And so I try to think about, okay, well, what are the ways that I can use my positionality then to advocate for changes alongside people who are more marginalized in that very community? Then you have transitive solidarity. Transitive solidarity is like, he takes it from the concept of transitive verbs. This is where solidarity is not a noun, it's an action. And so you have to be able to follow those things up. And then the last one that he talks about is creative solidarity. And I think that's really best described by the actual protest. So over the course of 3 days, these young folks organized through social media a protest where there was going to be a grounding kind of healing circle. People were going to have a chance to build out this Black Lives Matter mural that was hanging it, that afterward hung in the school for several years. And before that, they had a chance to come to campus and actually make protest signs. And if they weren't able to come to class or come to school during that day or so when they were doing protest signs, there'd be materials on site for them to do that work. And then they would go out and they were planning on doing a march and they were going to protest for an hour or two. And then they were going to come back and have sort of like a closing ceremony sort of thing, trying to kind of talk about commitments and healing. And all of this was planned through things that they had kind of like thought about and heard were happening in kind of the same kind of context of the George Floyd murder and the protests that ensued there and things that they had seen or things that they had heard about over social media that took place at George Floyd Square. And on the day of the protest, everything was kind of going very smoothly, like everything was going exactly as planned. And then they got out to protest across from the precinct, and it was the precinct and the school are blocked by a 6 foot tall chain link fence, but it had very sizable holes in it because the police actually had cut holes in the chain link fence to get flank positions on protesters during the evening. So there wasn't really a barrier so to speak. The fence was still standing, but it was not acting as a fence. And so people actually started to kind of filter in and out. I don't really talk about that a whole ton, but there are a number of adults who came in and they were like bringing water to the young folks. A student who wasn't able to come to the protest because he was working, and he worked at a pizza restaurant just down the block, told his manager what was happening, and the manager just made, I think it was like 8 or 10 pizzas, gave them for free to the young folks, and was like, "Here, like you deserve this. I want to recognize what you're doing." And they stayed out there for probably close to three, I want to say four, but it was probably closer to 3 hours. I think I was like trying to organize and kind of like do the behind the scenes thing. So that felt actually like it was a lot longer. And so there at the end of it, there wasn't really a grounding because they were felt so drawn to the energy. There were probably about 30, 50 students who were ended up being able to kind of like make it that day. And those numbers kind of ebbed and flowed as people had to go to work and things like that. But it was a really powerful space to be in. One of the strategies that they did that was really cool was they reached out to teachers because they were asking, like, how do we make sure, how do we insulate ourselves from the risks of adults from the school telling us that we can't do this anymore? And so we talked about that. And they really liked this one idea that one of the adults offered was like, what if you invited other adults to come show up and stand with you and like actually participate with you? And that went really, really well. Probably about 15 teachers showed up. And we're small, it was a small school. So 15 and a staff of, probably like, I don't know, I'm just ballparking it, maybe like 45, 50 teachers. So it was a decent showing. And then what ended up happening about that I talk about and was a very sobering realization, it's a hard truth, I think, to encounter, was that the young folks, the protest was ended very abruptly by district office administrators. And they sort of all kind of descended at the same time. It wasn't really clear what happened or why it happened. And as I was kind of coming back, I had just to kind of like stepped away to kind of talk to the principal and give him an update. What I had heard unfold was essentially that a district office administrator was kind of sitting around the edges watching and heard the students chanting F12. And then all of a sudden, a bunch of district office employees showed up and they were shutting it down. And as the students were, I was overhearing the conversations that the district office administrators were having with students. And they said, "You can't swear on national TV. You're making us look bad. Like, what are you doing to your community?" It went so far as like one of the students was giving an interview to the local public radio station about the protest. And he was pulled away by an administrator who identified herself as a social justice advocate who called herself an organizer and said, "You just don't do these things. You're making us all look bad, and you need to learn that this is not how you do these things just because you want to." And he left really, really dejected. We processed that moment because that was a pretty hard one for him because he was really trying to make a claim about like the importance of the community and the importance of the school and its willingness to kind of let this happen in some way. And having that thrown back in his face left a really sour taste in his mouth for years to come.
I mean, I can't imagine how insulting it is when you're trying to advocate for people's lives to be protected, to advocate against police brutality in the case of the murder of a young person, that a cuss word and representation seems to, like, how, I mean, those things are in scale in comparison so dramatically. And it's this, respect, this kind of politics where you're supposed to have this kind of respectfulness about it instead of doing the right thing. And I can only imagine how frustrating that is to kids who are doing this because their hearts hurt, right? Because they see injustice and they care deeply about it, which somehow adults so often can become callous to as we grow older, right? Somehow don't have the fire to fight injustice. So how did this, like, what did you learn from the end of this project? How did the, what was the resolution for you, for students in these events, which again, you see again, administrators not only not supporting them, but interrupting them, lecturing them, you know what I mean? Taking this side of, I don't even, you know, it's, you don't even have to take the wrong side if you're just interrupting them, telling them they're doing it the wrong way, you are, right? And I'm sure that's how that felt to the students.
Yeah, I mean, they left feeling really defeated. We had a private debrief circle for probably about an hour and a half where the other adults, the art teacher and the other adult that I was working with the youth research team, just kind of sat and listened, and we just kind of posed questions to them. And there was a reality, right, that set in where they're like, this school says that it's about racial justice. The school says that they care about us, that we're the ones that are supposed to be doing this. And this is where the kind of the title comes, where one of the young folks said, this was supposed to be for us, not them. And she kind of went on and she's like, but they made it about them. They made it about the district. And one of the kind of ironic twists of the story is the youth leaders talked to the national media that was present, because they came up, they're like, hey, can we film you? And the protesters were like, yeah, like, of course. And like, we have these scripts that are ready. So like, if you want to do interviews, you can, but you can also say no. And one of the things that the national media folks said to the youth organizers really early on was, if you swear on national TV, we cannot air it, just so you know. And so here was this really kind of full circle moment that illustrates where the kind of the investments of the district office officials really lied, right? Where had they just asked the question, like, hey, is it okay for you to do that? That they actually would have heard from the young people that were present, yeah, don't worry. They already told us that they couldn't air any swearing. But because that question was so, it wasn't necessary to ask, or it was just kind of in the heat of the moment and the adults decide, we just have to take over because this is getting out of control, that these young folks are leaving, you know, I said kind of a sour taste in their mouth. When we were debriefing, they were really clear. One of the young folks said it really well. She said, I think what I've learned is that I have no more tears. And if we want to make a change, it's up to us to make that change. And part of the thing I think that's hard about that is not, I mean, the realization is hard. It's hard to hear that in some ways, but it's also really inspiring. I think the hard truth is that so much of how we talk about young people in schools is really contradictory, but that contradiction makes sense. It's like, I want you to act like a developing adult in classrooms, but I'm going to treat you like you are incapable of things in the school setting for the sake of control, compliance. But I'm going to use the language of safety, because if I use the language of safety, that's really common sense. Like, if you aren't where you are, then I can say something like legal liability. And now that's a really compliance driven thing that is common sense. You don't, like, the school has to be responsible to know where you are at any given time. So we're going to surveil you, and we're going to make sure you're in class. And that's just the thing that we have to do. It's for your own safety. These are literally kind of paraphrased ideas that I have heard administrators and teachers kind of share throughout my teaching career in all sorts of different places. And in this moment, it really crystallized for me as these young people are coming to the realization that if they want their school community to be different, they are going to have to be the ones to change it. What was so beautiful about that is that in many ways, it would have been really easy for them to just kind of be like, we're good. That was a hard lesson to learn. I'm holding that in my heart and in my body in so many ways. And what they did instead was they said, all right, what are we going to do? So that those youth organizers, because they were in the youth research team that I was working with them in, their entire research agenda became, what is the mental and emotional well-being of our peers? So they did a survey where they got over, I think they got somewhere between 300 and 400 responses from grades 6 through 12 on a survey of basically like, you know, what is it like for you to be in school when you are like really emotionally low? Like, where do you go? Are adults helping you navigate those situations? Are they making it worse? There were kind of like a lot of other questions, but that's kind of the synthesis of that. And what they found in their research was that actually adults were making issues of emotional duress significantly worse for young folks in the school. And so they advocated for a youth-directed, basically kind of like a reset room. I mean, taking that language from like thinking about all these different kind of like approaches to restorative justice right now. I laugh because there's a lot of different kind of like ironic twists with restorative justice and the way it's being used, right? But smarter people than me have talked about that or are talking about that. But what they did was they said, all right, we need this. We're going to advocate for it. They, from their research, they use their research to justify making a policy request to the district office. And it caught the attention of someone who was plugged into kind of like broader networks of like emotional wellness training. And she reached out and was like, hey, actually, there is this organization that is really interested in things like this, and they have grants. Do you think they'd be interested in applying? So they did, and they got just under $10,000 to start this room that they ended up calling the Purple Room. And it was a space where it was youth-led, and young people didn't need to check, like they didn't need and to give a reason why they were going to this room. It was kind of like there were kind of they built with shower curtains and like really soft furniture and kind of this nice like LED lighting versus the kind of harsh fluorescence of classrooms. This space where people could just go and be alone or kind of like figure like if they needed to cry, they could just like cry in the privacy of like one of these like curtained off areas in a in what was an old classroom. And that was a really beautiful thing to see them build and then also get off the ground. Now, there were obviously some hiccups with that. For example, like adults were really concerned about safety, right? Unsurprisingly. And they, so what the students did though, from what they, the lessons they had learned from the protests, they said, all right, well, let's go find adults that we trust and we're going to bring them along. We're not going to let any adult into this space. And then we're going to set really clear parameters and actually host a training for what they termed their safety net, which were adults they trusted to basically be in the room to keep other adults away. And so we would go into that, and it was like, I remember talking to other adults who would go in and we would take shifts in the room throughout the next year, and they would leave and they'd be like, that was actually one of the like best rooms I've ever been in. Can I take more shifts? I feel so calm. I feel so like restored. And your job was literally just to kind of like be present. So that was one example. Another one was that the school started its first ever Black Student Union. And in that Black Student Union, they organized the first ever HBCU spring break trip where the school is a majority Black school. And we did not have access to HBCU college reps in kind of like a sustained way. We would have one or two kind of flow through every now and then because they were making a trip to Minneapolis for some reason. But they took a group of, I want to say, 15 students for a week on a bus trip. It was fully funded. They fundraised for the entire thing. They organized the entire thing. And those folks were came back with a mission. And that's been a really special thing. It was a really special thing to see get off the ground and sustain itself. And it's really sustained itself since that was 3 years ago. And they're setting up their third trip, I believe, which is pretty exciting. So the lessons that I learned were like one, like affirm that young people are absolutely brilliant and they just need space to be able to, you know, what's the colloquialism I've heard recently? They just need space to cook. And
Is
the
that the
sec,
they need space to cook?
yeah, they just need space to cook.
Just cooking.
And that was one of the lessons as an adult. It's like, okay, so then in solidarity and in school context, it's about how do we create conditions, right? So much of, I think, like justice work gets framed in like, how do I show up and how do I participate? And that's fair. And I think what I learned was sometimes that participation means taking not just a back seat, but like stepping behind the curtain of the performance and making sure everything's running smoothly on the back end. Making sure that the administrators don't have to agree, but they understand that they're not getting in the way. Being able to take those risks of, you know, in her book, we want to do more than survive, right? It's like, what are you willing to sacrifice for these moves of educational justice? And to be, again, to reiterate this point, because I think it's something that I constantly think about, and I think people I really trust and scholars I really admire keep coming back to it, is like the calculation of risk, or how risk is sort of like meted out in society, is not evenly distributed. So in what ways do we need to account for that? Not just as adults within school contexts where that asymmetry of power is so obvious, but also in terms of those intersectional dynamics of race, gender, sexuality, class, right? And so being willing to show up and say, all right, I'm gonna take these risks here because this thing actually matters. And for me, it was a really selfish act, because the way that I was changing as a person and the type of person I was around young people was so much more meaningful than the kind of convention of kind of like teaching as I came to it was 11 years prior, that it was just a situation where I was like, I can't look back from this because I just don't want to. I like who I am. Even if that means that I'm going to get in trouble, even if that means that I might have to go find a job at the end of this year. And I didn't know I would. Yeah. At the end of the day, I didn't get in trouble, largely because there were other adults who were willing to step up and take the political pressure off of myself and other kind of like closely located organizers. And so I want to honor that work that they did too, right? It really does take a lot of different people doing a lot of different things.
It seems like you definitely had a good support with your, it was your principal. And so I think that's a good, like, finding support for yourself. I feel like you've given us some really great advice. Letting kids cook, I thought was a, but giving them space to cook, I thought was a really, I have to, I like that one. I want to build it into my repertoire.
Yeah. And part of it is like, it's hard, right? Like, it's sometimes it's hard to let kids cook. Mm-hmm. I remember when I was teaching a class at, like, right now I'm a visiting professor at Carleton. Carleton College, it's a liberal arts college in southern Minnesota. And, you know, I'll turn to them and be like, what do you want today to be about? And they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, These are supposed to be young folks who are like incredibly brilliant, and they are, right? And they're also really good at school. Like, they're good at the game of school. And they're so good at the game of school that, like, the project that I see as an educator is like, oh, how do I help you see that there's other ways to think about our time together than this transactional, like, I've read more books than you, and I have spent more money on pieces of paper than you that hang on my wall, than like posing it back to them of like, well, what do you want to do today? And I had one student actually today, and she said to me, she's like, it's a weird question to ask because we know that we're supposed to respond to you, but our entire lives have told us up to this point that you're right and we're wrong. So why would we say anything when you're just going to tell us what to think? And that's a really heavy thing to kind of process, right? That speaks to the social and cultural reproduction that school perpetuates.
Right. It's
I got really good at the game of life for a while, like really good. Like, I was so good at this game, but I'm not going to lie to you, it has done me nothing. And also, I'm no longer as good anymore, but I don't know why. For like a good, like 6 month period, I was killing it at life. It did not transfer to actual life, but man, moving those little people around in that car.
Yeah, it does sometimes feel like, and I feel like this, it's like schooling and academia, it's almost like they're designed to keep us so busy that we can't attend to the most important things in our world, right? We can't attend to, it's like we want to go, you know, to a rally for justice or climate change or some issue, but I have to do all this work. I'm on this committee and I'm on this thing and on this thing. It's like, and we're doing all of these things we've created. And so I really appreciate in your study and in your talk in this podcast, the care you put forth in having listened to students. And it's very evident in your scholarship. You're very careful about the ideas you use and how you employ them. And so thank you so much for putting so much care and thoughtfulness into this, because I think it's a great model. Your writing and your research is a great model for the way you're approaching this issue of listening and caring for students and giving them space. So you got to let the kids cook, Michael. Sorry, we're old men. You bring the kids' phrases in here, we're very excited. It's energizing.
Yeah, you gotta try, right?
Yeah, it's like drinking from the fountain of youth for us.
Ryan, thank you so much for joining us. We definitely appreciate the fact that you're hanging out with us. Much appreciated. Do you mind telling us where folks can find you or your work online? I know you're coming soon to the University of Minnesota.
Yes. So I'll be at the University of Minnesota. You can reach out to me. I'm currently at Carleton College as a visiting assistant professor of educational studies. Otherwise, yeah, you can Google me. I think I'm on the internet. I try to stay clear of social media just because I'm not good at it. It's not an investment that I have.
Young Is anyone have really good at it? I don't know. Even the people that are supposedly good at it, I don't know if they're good at it. They should be playing more Game of Life.
Right. And yeah, I'm happy to answer any questions. Like, this work is really hard, and it's also like the most rewarding. Learning how to listen to young folks is, I think, one of the greatest challenges and one of the most rewarding things I've done as an educator.
Well, thank you, Dr. Otto, again, for joining us today. We certainly do hope to continue the discussion in person, online, however it unfolds.
Yeah, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for being here. Now, at the Visions of Education podcast, we're all about sharing the learning. If you're doing something fun or creative in education, I guess you can tweet us at Visions of Ed. We're also, I guess, on Facebook. And you should also subscribe if you haven't yet on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, and anywhere you'd like us to be. We can be there. We're like the Friends people. We'll be there for you. That's a dated reference now that I'm realizing that.
Mm-hmm.
That was a program from the 90s.
And also maybe a promise we can't keep. But if you write us a 5-star review, we will read it on the air.
We can keep that promise.
You can, you know, have all your students in your class tell them to log on and just all give us a 5-star review at once. That'd be very effective. But if they don't want to, don't make them do it. We'd also like to thank Zach Seitz of Wiley High School and the University of North Texas for his editing skills. Yeah, increasingly I'm not on social media, but I am a human being. So come say hi to me in person, or maybe like write me a handwritten letter.
And I'm anywhere where there's a life game board. I'll be there. Just keep it open for me.
We're going to make this happen. We're going to get together and play life. I feel like I played it once when I was like 7. Until next time, this is the Visions of Education podcast.
Signing off.